Hello, everybody, and welcome to the National Geographic Society program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I'll be reading today were all published in November of 2024. We'll begin with this article titled "The Forgotten History of Cats in the Navy." Sailors embraced their feline colleagues, giving them tiny uniforms and their very own hammocks. But cats are natural outlaws, so it couldn't last forever. They had names such as Tom the Terror, Wackle, Bounce, and Dirty Face. They traveled thousands of miles on the most storied warships with some of the saltiest sailors. They were valued members of the crew, often issued custom miniature uniforms and their own tiny hammocks. Many never set a paw on dry land during their entire lives. They were the cats that served in the world's navies. Cats have been on ships for almost as long as humans have been going to sea, and sailors have been largely responsible for spreading cats across the globe. Ancient Egyptian tomb paintings depict cats hunting from boats sailing down the Nile, while Phoenicians recognized the value of controlling the rodent population on their ships as they traded throughout the Mediterranean. Rats and mice were a major problem on ships because they ruined the crew's food, chewed through equipment, and spread disease. Cats, with their predatory prowess, were a cheap and effective solution to any vermin infestation. The U.S. government, in an effort to protect documents from nesting rats, began to purchase clouders of cats in the 19th century, eventually supplying them to the U.S. Navy. In the United Kingdom, one of the earliest and largest cat rescue programs occurred during the First World War, when thousands of strays were rounded up in cities and given to the military. The cats supplied to the Royal Navy even received a weekly victualling allowance of 1 shilling and 6 pence to pay for treats from the ship's canteen. Angels, devils, and furry barometers. Early sailors believed that cats could control the weather with their tails. When feline tails twitched in a certain manner, people once reasoned it meant the cats were angry and preparing to unleash a violent storm that would soon fall over the ship. Later, sailors realized that cats twitched their tails when they were agitated by a sudden drop in air pressure, indicating that the ship was heading into unfavorable weather. Crews began to monitor all the mannerism of their ship's cats and viewed any unusual behavior as a storm warning. The felines were, in a sense, little furry barometers. They were also a source of superstitions. Seamen prepared to sail considered it good luck when a cat chose to board their vessel. However, they feared disaster if they had a long-time ratter that decided to jump ship just prior to setting sail. Even worse, sailors thought their fate was sealed if they saw two cats fighting on the pier. It meant that an angel and devil had already started to battle for the souls of the crew. 9 lives on the high seas. Though cats are known for their aversion to water, they acclimated quite well to life on the sea. Unlike the limeys of the Royal Navy, who famously had to drink citrus juice to prevent scurvy, cats make their own vitamin C and can survive on a diet consisting of fish and mammals without needing to eat fruits and vegetables. And when rodents were in short supply, cats had different methods for catching fish for themselves. The easiest prey were the ones that simply washed up on deck. Some cats overcame their dislike of water to become skilled divers that could snatch fish from the ocean. The cats that never got comfortable with swimming still managed to hunt by deftly knocking down fish leaping over the ship's bow. Because cats got most of the moisture they needed from eating the fish, they did not require a lot of potable water like human sailors. In addition, cats have an excellent internal filtration system that allows them to drink a bit of seawater if necessary. Feline companions were also important for boosting morale among homesick sailors on long voyages, providing the crew with much-needed affection and a bit of softness in the Spartan environment of ship. Since cats were considered mascots to be shared by all the sailors, they also helped to create bonds among the crew. The animals are notoriously difficult to train to do tricks, but some sailors claim they learned to speak cat and were able to get their mascots to perform feats such as standing at attention, saluting, walking tight ropes, and ringing bells. This especially contributed to the U.S. Navy's goodwill efforts in foreign ports when locals were invited for ship tours that included a brief show featuring performing cats. Natural outlaws and political liabilities. Larger Navy ships could have as many as 24 cats that established their own territories. The one that was smart enough to claim a ship's galley usually became the fattest. Other mousers stayed in the bowels of the ship, where they would not be as bothered by all the activity on the deck and the sounds of the guns. The friendliest felines were happy to stay in the berthing area, where they received plenty of attention from sailors and could sleep in hammocks that reduced the swaying of the ship. After all, ship cats could get just as seasick as humans. Following the end of the Second World War, the special position that cats held on Navy ships began a rapid decline. Due to improvements in fumigation and pest control, cats became outmoded in their primary job to rid ships of vermin. Ship captains who were not cat lovers started to categorize felines as an unnecessary distraction. A bigger problem for the cats in the U.S. Navy was that they became a political and legal liability in the immediate post-World War II era. The defense budget was slashed, and the Navy was downsized dramatically, alarming admirals who believed that they were being cut to the bone and left without a fleet sufficient enough to protect the nation's interests against the rising threat of communism. Members of Congress who were advocating deep defense cuts ridiculed the admirals by revealing that one ship had used resources for a 3-man committee to plan a funeral for their mascot cat. It was a cheap shot because the costs of keeping cats to maintain morale was nominal and often paid by the crews themselves. But it embarrassed the admirals by giving the public the impression that the Navy was spending money frivolously. More than anything, it was new and stricter international quarantine laws that ended the tradition of the ship's cat. Prior to the 1950s, many nations gave ship's cats special status that made them exempt from quarantine laws, allowing them to roam free in foreign ports where perhaps the worst consequence was a scrap with a local tom. The laws enacted by most countries after the war forbade cats from leaving a ship before going through a lengthy quarantine period. If local officials caught a cat sneaking off a ship, the captain could be heavily fined or even placed under arrest. Recognizing that cats are natural outlaws, the Navy wanted to avoid having their captains involved in illegal and diplomatic dust-ups due to a curious cat trying to circumvent quarantine. Current U.S. Navy policy does not explicitly ban cats on ships, but the special permission that sailors now need to bring a feline friend on board is almost never granted. Most navies of the world have adopted a similar policy, except for Russia. And that's the end of the first article. The title was The Forgotten History of Cats in the Navy. And there was no author cited for the work. The title of the next article is This New Tool Will Help Upend Everything We Assumed About Ancient Gender Roles. Proteomics, the study of proteins present in our genetic makeup, is a cheaper and easier method than using ancient DNA to determine sex. A new revelation that the remains of a powerful ancient man buried in an elaborate tomb in Spain are actually female is challenging assumptions about the roles of women in early European societies. But it's also a vivid example of the game-changing new ways that archaeologists are using the study of proteins that make up the complex biochemistry encoded in cellular DNA. By examining proteins in organic artifacts like teeth and bones, scientists can now learn details of the DNA that created them, but without having to analyze any actual DNA that may have survived. Such techniques, called proteomics, have the capacity to revolutionize archaeology, says Marta Sintas Pina, an archaeologist at the University of Seville and the lead author of a new study that used proteomics to determine the sex of the woman in the tomb. The study, published today in Scientific Reports, describes the discovery of a tomb in 2008 at Valencina de Concepcion, a town near Seville in southern Spain. It lies within a vast burial ground dated to Iberia's Copper Age, between 4200 and 5200 years ago, and it was one of the richest tombs ever found in Spain, with lavish grave goods that included an entire elephant's tusk, a dagger with a crystal blade, and dozens of mother-of-pearl beads. Archaeologists at the time suggested the person buried there was a man aged between 17 and 25, based on their assessment of the skeletal remains. The grave goods indicated he had held an elite position in society. But a new examination of the tooth enamel from the individual's remains shows the presence of proteins made by genes on an X chromosome, but no equivalent proteins made by genes on a Y chromosome. That suggests the person in the tomb was biologically female, XX, and not male, XY. Sintas Pina and study senior author Leonardo Garcia San Juan, also had at the University of Seville, say their new discovery challenges models of prehistoric societies in Iberia that suggest they were led by charismatic men. But our study shows that was not necessarily the case, the researchers say. Instead, it seems that women could also be leaders, forcing a rethink of the societal roles of women in Copper Age Iberia and elsewhere. Revolutionizing archaeology. While breakthroughs in the study of ancient DNA are enabling archaeologists to extract detailed information from archaeological remains, from sex down to eye color, the process can be expensive and time-consuming, with samples prone to contamination, when there's actually enough DNA to recover. Proteomics, on the other hand, can be used to create a partial genetic profile from remains regardless of the presence of DNA in the sample. It allows you to get a very small genotype from DNA, even when the DNA in a sample is degraded and gone, says Glendon Parker at the University of California, Davis, a pioneer in proteomics who has spent more than a decade researching forensic and archaeological applications. Parker's study also shows proteins are often more stable and better preserved in ancient bones and teeth than DNA. It is always the case that if you have DNA, you will have protein, he says. But if you have protein, you may not have DNA. Using proteomics to determine the sex of human remains is more effective, cheaper, and faster than ancient DNA analysis, agree Cintas Pena and Garcia San Juan. Although the method is only a few years old, it's already having a scientific impact, they say. The result we present in the paper confirms the efficiency of the technique. Proteomics and ancient DNA. Like the researchers with the Copper Age burial in Spain, being able to determine sex from proteins in human tooth enamel has also been invaluable to Peruvian archaeologist and National Geographic explorer Gabriel Prieto, who wasn't involved in the latest study. He sent teeth from the victims of a mass child sacrifice by the Chimú people of Peru to his co-researcher Parker. The proteins revealed the key sacrifices were male children. It really helped us to understand that, at least for this event, boys were the most important sacrificial victims, Prieto says. Chimú sacrifices involved hundreds of victims, so ancient DNA analysis would have been prohibitively expensive, even if viable DNA could be found in each set of remains. And while DNA analysis is ongoing for some of the sacrificial victims, it's to complement the proteomics, for example, to show if any of the victims were related. Proteomics and ancient DNA work together, Prieto says, but if we have the chance to do the proteomics, then we go with that. Proteomics in archaeology and animals. Besides providing genetic information from animal and human remains, proteomics can also be used to investigate microorganisms that caused ancient diseases, such as leprosy or plagues, to identify food residues on ancient pottery, and to determine sources of fibers used in ancient textiles, which could provide insight into ancient trading networks. Biomolecular archaeologist Michael Buckley at the University of Manchester in the United Kingdom has developed the proteomics of collagen, the main protein in bones, into the Zoo Archaeology by Mass Spectrometry, or ZooMS, method of determining which animal species a particular bone from an archaeological site came from. The technique was recently used to show that ivory in a 5th or 6th century English grave came from an African elephant, which implies a previously unknown trade route across the ancient world at that time. It's great that ZooMS is taking off in a big way now, Buckley says. One of the most promising aspects is that we're starting to generate much larger amounts of data and getting much better information about human interactions with animals in the past. That completes the article. The title was "This New Tool Will Help Upend Everything We Assumed About Ancient Gender Roles." Again, no article or no author was cited for the article. Our next article is titled "Discover the Planet's Last Few Naturally Quiet Places." From Taiwan to Namibia, peaceful places remind us that quiet has the power to remedy a variety of health issues. Written by Terry Ward. Quiet may be making a comeback, especially for people looking to escape life's regular stresses and the vices of technology. Just ask acoustic ecologist Gordon Hempton about the importance of finding quiet places. It's become his mission as the co-founder of Quiet Parks International, or QPI, a nonprofit dedicated to putting natural quiet within reach of as much of the world's population as possible by certifying and protecting peaceful places. 4 years ago, QPI certified the world's first urban quiet park in one of the most densely populated places on the planet, just north of Taipei, Taiwan. Yangmishan National Park is a 43-square-mile area known for its relaxing hot springs, mountainous terrain, and endemic birds. Urban Quiet Parks offers natural beauty and inner stillness on a daily basis, and they offer it to a target set of people who desperately need quiet, says Vikram Shahan, president of QPI. Rather than complete silence, natural quiet is defined as the sounds of nature without human-made noise. QPI's goal is to certify roughly 50 urban quiet parks worldwide, in addition to wilderness quiet parks. This year, QPI recognized Nimbi Rand Nature Reserve in Windhoek, Namibia, as Africa's first wilderness quiet park, underscoring the 494,000-acre reserve's commitment to preserving its pristine natural environment and fostering a quiet sanctuary for humans and animals. The organization is eyeing potential urban quiet parks in cities such as New York City, New Orleans, Paris, and Brisbane, Australia. While there are no naturally quiet places left on Earth, according to Hampton, human-made noise, usually in the form of transportation, by highway, rail, air, and boat, pervades every corner of the planet. QPI uses varying standards of stillness to certify its wilderness and urban quiet parks. Regular acoustic studies are carried out after a park's certification to ensure it meets QPI's standards. Natural sounds, of course, register increased decibels. Imagine the pound of surf on a beach or a chorus of singing frogs. But the goal, explains Ulf Bowman, executive director of Urban Quiet Parks, is for the background noise to be no higher than 45 decibels. That's akin to library-level chatter. Where hush is healing. The effects of noise pollution on humans have been widely studied and attributed to health issues that range from stress and sleep disturbances to high blood pressure and heart disease. Places with natural quiet are also important to animals, says Jesse Barber, professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at Boise State University. Human-caused noise is known to interfere with animals' abilities to hear important sounds, like birdsong, and to fundamentally alter where animals live and their reproductive fitness, he says. Even U.S. national parks experience significant noise exposure at levels known to impact wildlife, says Barber. In a noise reduction study at Muir Woods National Monument in California, where signs urged visitors to turn down the volume in one area of the park, he says, the result was an increased number of birds near the trails. In the U.S., the areas with the most potential for tranquil experiences are those with the least flyover traffic from airplanes and remoteness from other transportation noises, according to Les Bloomberg, founder and executive director of the Noise Pollution Clearinghouse, a nonprofit organization that has mapped out the last remaining places of natural quiet in the continental U.S. The organization's research indicates that places including the Boundary Waters Canoe Area of northern Minnesota and Bob Marshall Wilderness Complex in western Montana are among the country's last remaining natural quiet areas. The northernmost U.S. states are generally more likely to have spaces of natural quiet, says Bloomberg. Hampton points to Halikakala National Park in Maui, the crater of which he considers the quietest place on Earth. Glacier National Park and Big Bend National Park, among the U.S. parks that have embarked on initial certification as wilderness quiet parks with QPI. Internationally, Elk Island National Park in Canada, Balawiza National Park in eastern Poland, and Rio Calero National Reserve in Chile are in varying stages of the process, he says. Once you certify a place as a quiet park, it eventually changes behaviors, much in the same way people have learned about the importance of recycling through education and awareness, says Kenya Williams, founder of Hush Soundscape Planning and Design. Williams, also an advisor for QPI, believes a cultural shift is necessary to help people value and steward quiet in urban areas. And with that, we have run out of time. The title of this article was Discover the Planet's Last Few Natural Quiet Places by Terry Ward. This has been the National Geographic Society program brought to you by SunSounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your SunSounds volunteer reader. The articles I've read today were all published in November of 2024 by the Geographic Society. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to SunSounds of Arizona. And if you've missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on the broadcast info and audio. On the next screen, click on the word demand. Then you'll see a list of programs available to you. Hopefully you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.